Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, here with our other host, Mr. Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul, and hello to you, the listener. How are you, Paul?
Well, I'm fine. And what about a quick look at the weather predictions for today? We're getting more nice weather.
Beautiful summer days are predicted for the rest of the week and into early next week, with sunny days ranging comfortably between 80 and 87 or so degrees. Thunderstorms may occur on Friday night, but the sun should return, only a chance of rain on Tuesday. This week, I'm sure that we'll see considerable growth and tomatoes are coming into season. Paul, you have some information to share about upcoming events of interest.
Yeah, we always like to highlight things that are coming up in the area. And we happen to have two events coming up in Story City this weekend. First of all, on Saturday, Peter J. Grady will be acting on our stage in Story City. He'll be at the high school auditorium at 2 p.m. on Saturday, portraying Ulysses Grant. It's called Unconditional Surrender. And Peter, I think we have Peter on the line. Are you there, Peter?
I'm here.
Hello,
I'm
Peter.
Enjoying the weather forecast with all of your listeners. It sounded just wonderful.
Oh, good. You might tell us a little bit about how you got started portraying General Grant.
Okay. I am fortunate to have a resemblance to him, and that resemblance was commented on several times in the last several years, and so I started looking at his life and trying to find if there were any plays that had been put together with him, and there really aren't any. And so, in a burst of hubris, I guess, I decided I was going to write my own. And so I did some research, and I crafted a one-man show, and have been putting the show on now for a couple of years, all around Central Iowa and elsewhere.
Well, we're looking forward to your performance.
It's been a fascinating experience.
Well, I actually saw your performance at the Civil War Roundtable in Des Moines, and you do a fantastic job.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That was one of my first performances.
Is that right?
I'm glad to hear it came off well.
You look like an accomplished performer to me right off the bat, doing a good job portraying Grant. And Grant's an interesting guy. You know, he was a rock star after the war. I read an account of a reception at the White House, and Lincoln was ignored. Everyone grouped around Grant, and he became famous after his presidency. The whole world followed his trip around the world. And I know that in your presentation you cover the end of his life when he was diagnosed with throat cancer and published his memoirs,
yes,
published by Samuel Clemens, otherwise known as Mark Twain. And that's very interesting how you handle that. So I think you've written a good presentation that's all-encompassing about his career.
Well, I hope folks are able to come out to see it. I think everyone who attends will learn a little something about history that they had never quite heard before, and they'll walk away with a new appreciation of Grant. I remember my wife once said that when she was a kid, all she knew about Grant was that he was president of the United States, he was a Union general, and he was a drunk. And that's about all she knew. unfortunately, that caricature has kind of come down to us. And hopefully I'm able to flesh him out as a human being and as a very remarkable, remarkable man.
Well, you know, when you look in New York City and see his tomb and the size of it and the breadth of it and the amount of money it took to build it, that's a measure of how important Grant was in the eyes of his peers and in his time.
Absolutely, absolutely. For a man who lived only until he was 63 years old, to have been twice elected president of the United States, to have been the winning general in the Civil War, to have had ups and downs in business and personal life and health, a remarkable man and a remarkable life. I think he's one of these folks that if you think long and hard about American history, he inevitably comes forward as one of the preeminent people that really helped shape our nation.
And his life really shows you that no matter how far down you fall, you can always rise up, and that you can make victory out of defeat.
Yes, he certainly fell pretty low in his life, and one of my favorite stories is that At one point, he was so poor that all he could do was chop down firewood and sell it off an ox cart in the streets of St. Louis, Missouri, because he had failed at everything else that he had tried. And then he moved to Galena, Illinois, and the war began, and he was able to lead the victorious Union armies. Remarkable fellow.
After his presidency, he lost all his money on the stock market. And that's why he had to write his memoirs in such a pressing way. He was dying of cancer and wanted to have a legacy of financial security for his family. So right at the end of his life, it was a catastrophe.
Yes, and that's frankly the thing that gave me the opportunity to write this show, because I'm an old man, I'm in ill health, and I'm looking back over my life, and as a result, I'm able to tell people about my life, about those remarkable periods in American history, and flesh out that whole era, both before and after the Civil War. We all learn a little bit about the Civil War, even as kids in school, but the period immediately leading up to it and the period after are fascinating and help shape the American character as well as just about anything else.
Peter Grady portraying Ulysses Grant in Unconditional Surrender, presented at the Roland Story High School Auditorium, Saturday at 2 p.m. We'll see you there, Peter.
Okay, thank you. I look forward to seeing you all. Bye-bye.
And another event that's coming up in Story County. This goes back to a long time, 25 years they've been doing ragtime in Randall. And Randall is a town of less than 200 people. And yet for 25 years they've held this Ragtime in Randall Festival, where well-known piano players congregate to put on this show in October. But they also do a couple of other events during the year. One of them is called Sunday Best, and that will be featuring this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Elam Lutheran Church in Randall. And it's not hard to find it, because Randall has its own exit off Interstate 35. This is called Our Sunday Best, and it's the Harmony Brigade Barbershop Chorus out of Fort Dodge. And I see the picture here of the chorus. There's a boy 16 years of age, and there's a guy 93 years of age. So
that's right.
It's quite, and they're all wearing lavender shirts with white ties. And you can go and see the Harmony Brigade Barbershop Chorus this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Elam Lutheran Church in Randall, Iowa. Just take the Randall exit. Presented by RAFAC, Randall Fine Arts Committee, which also has done Ragtime. So two big events coming up in Story County.
And we'll put information about that on the website today, too.
I was hoping you'd say
yes,
that.
For yes, for future reference. Okay. Thank you.
Well, you're listening to Local Talk. This is Wednesday, so here we go, exploring in our 7-county Central Iowa listening area. And today we're going to the city of Nevada with the help of Nevada Historical Society's Chris Corbin, and he's a volunteer there and also vice chairman of the board. And he drove over to KHOI from Nevada, and he's here with us. Thank you for coming, Chris. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
KHOI reporter Greta Anderson and I went to Nevada to look around, and Chris was a wonderful host. He showed us the mansion called the Briggs Terrace, and it was really fun. I recorded parts of the house tour that describes what it's like to live in a 19th century estate house, and I'll share some of that later in the hour, as well as have Chris tell us more about it. But while I was in Nevada, I also stopped by the home of a Nevada resident named Jessica Ionson. Jessica is one of a number of Nevada residents who actively fan the flames of community spirit and goodwill. The Nevada Fire Department was a target recently for their kindness. Since KHOI's mission is to build community, we wanted to learn more about all this, and Jessica ended up painting a really interesting portrait in words of Nevada.
I'm Jessica Ionson. I'm originally from Nevada, but my husband and I, we've been back in Nevada for about 6 years, and we love it here.
We're sitting out on your front yard,
yep,
looking out across the cornfield. Right now it's golden with sun.
Very beautiful.
You live on the edge of town, and across the street is a view that goes all the way to Colo.
It is. It's a beautiful sight. I love it. I'm a housewife, but I love helping people. There's all sorts of stuff, all the events that we have, the way that the community gets together to do things for others to help them when they're in a time of need. It's just wonderful, positive feeling.
Now tell us about what happened recently with the fire department.
Well, actually, Amanda Pope, the citizen in Nevada, her father was the fire chief.
Is this a volunteer fire department?
It is. It is a volunteer fire department, yes. These are great people. They're just wonderful people. Amanda Pope had just this little thought cross her mind, and she talked to her cousin about it, Drew. But she decided to do this.
A little bit ambient sound here.
Yeah, exactly. The funny thing is, they don't usually honk their horns. She thought of the idea of how to show that we do support our volunteer fire department. And she thought of this idea, and I saw it through Facebook, and an event through Facebook. So then I just spread the word through Facebook, social media, friends, talking with friends, texting, seeing them out, and I just shared it. And then...
And what was the plan?
Just to bombard them with water.
Why bombard them with water?
Because we just love them.
What do you mean by bombarding them with water?
Well, when they go out on calls, especially in this heat, they drink so much water to keep hydrated. They have all their gear on, and they're fighting this heat, the water, you know, just exerting themselves to help save others. We need to keep them hydrated so they can do what they need to do to try to help.
So you're giving them drinking water.
Yes,
not water to put out fires.
Yes, drinking water, bottles of water.
What did you collect?
We collected 800 cases of bottled water, and we also collected $1,085 in cash and checks. The cash and checks will be written to the Colo Fire Department from the citizens of Nevada.
The Colo Fire Department.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that just lost a fire chief.
Correct. Correct. Mm-hmm. Just to show that we do support them, whether it's Colo, Nevada, Maxwell, surrounding areas, we support all of our public safety departments because they do so much for us.
How did you collect the water for the fire department?
Well, I have to say, Amanda Pope is the one who thought of it, got it going, and then when I saw it on social media, I just shouted it to the rooftops, so to speak, to everybody I knew, and I talked to everybody like in the community through phone calls and all that stuff. I wanted everybody to see how Nevada actually does care about their safety department. We just all showed up at the fire station, and it was actually pretty awesome to see. So many other citizens came up at the time of the drop-off, and it was just amazing to see car after car, load after load of cases of bottled water being given. And then the firefighters would take it to a big old stack of water that they had in the station.
And how did the firemen react?
They were just, wow, they were amazed. And it was just beautiful to see all the smiles on their faces. I was on cloud nine for a couple of days to see just the support that actually did come out.
You do other projects that have to do with community spirit.
I'm not the one to take all the credit. Right now we do have a fundraiser going on. It's Mower for Carter Milton, the fire captain's son. He's known around town for mowing lawns, and he's helped the elderly mow their lawns, not expecting return of cash or anything. He's just that kind-hearted. But he was driving his mower over 6th Street train tracks, his lawnmower, and he had a little trailer. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And he drove it over the 6th Street train tracks, and it somehow got stuck, and a train was coming, so he got off. Thankfully, he got off of his mower, but the mower was destroyed. I think the train was going 48 miles per hour when it hit. And
it crushed it.
It was lodged under the train for quite some time, but...
So the train came to a stop.
It had to stop to get the lodged lawnmower from under it. So thanks to the fire department and the safety department, they were able to get it out.
So the train stopped, and then they had to go under the train, but it was crushed.
Yes, it was. It was a goner. So...
These things happen in Iowa.
Exactly. The train checks. And immediately after we heard that, so many people started getting things rolling. And Jeff Steffies went to Van Wall, talked to Van Wall about getting a mower for him. And then he went to open a bank account for Carter. And then started the next day the fundraising was going, and then I made an event on Facebook, and then we're all just trying to spread the word to help him get back on his feet.
So how's it going?
So far, so good. There's about $300 in there so far.
What else have you been part of?
You know, I've lived here for so many years. There's so many things. A few years ago, we did a bake sale for a classmate of mine who's really close. And their son had a small jaw problem. I don't know that it's a technical term. It's hard to say. But we did a bake sale for him at State Bank and Trust. And we ended up collecting about $2,600 for him through baked goods. The community came together, baked goods, left them, came together, bought the baked goods, and just donated money and their time. And we got $2,600 for him.
Being helpful is a cultural lifestyle in Nevada?
I think so. I'm proud to be from Nevada. There's also, to honor our veterans, Mitzi Alexander, a graphic designer and an artist. She has a potluck fundraiser, so she can paint a mural of a flag that's been approved, and it'll honor our veterans. Of course, all the Legion's free will donation meals that they have throughout the years. There's the Cubbies Cupboard. That's a food pantry. You can give food to them. There's Back to School Supply Drive, where kids that need school supplies, they're able to get school supplies. There's Backpack for Buddies. Before every weekend, they get a backpack full of food, so they have something to eat throughout the weekend. Mm-hmm. And then there's Harmony Closet, where you can donate or go in to get clothes or that you may need. Our community helps one another, and it's just so great.
People getting together to promote community spirit.
It happens every single day. Like yesterday, a friend brought somebody a tub of ice cream to the door just to tell them thank you. Another person saw a neighbor who just happened to drive down the street. He saw that she had her van open or her truck open with a whole bunch of 35-pound things of dog food, and he stopped halfway down the street, came back, and helped her unload. It's just the little things. That's what our community is.
Okay, now when you talk about these things, you clearly think this is fun.
It is. Being positive is wonderful, and to be able to help somebody is great. Probably maybe 6 months ago, I had a girlfriend or a friend. She didn't have a lot of food to feed her kids, so I'm a housewife. I don't have a lot of money. So I went into my deep freeze, found what I could, looked in my cupboards, made a sack for her, and gave it to her. And she was eternally grateful. Mm-hmm. And she said, "What do you want in return?" "All I want is you to pay it forward."
Pay it forward.
Yes.
Explain paying it forward.
Well, the pay it forward to me is just doing something nice and not respecting anything in return, of course. And just asking that person to do something nice for some stranger or somebody you know. I was always taught my mother's, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. Well, you know, I would want somebody to help me if I was in need, so I'm going to help that person, mm-hmm. regardless who they are. Whether I like them or know them or not, I'm going to help them.
Okay. The last word here?
The last word? just Nevada proud. When you're proud of your community is strong.
This is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and our mission is to build community through communication. And we want to thank Jessica Ianson, a Nevada resident, for giving voice to community so eloquently today. Now, we're talking about Nevada, the county seat of Story County. We're getting some help from Nevada Historical Society's Chris Corbin, and he's with us from Nevada Historical Society, a volunteer there, vice chairman of the board. Please tell us a little about Nevada Historical Society, Chris.
Well, it's a volunteer organization, nonprofit. We have actually three locations that we have property. We've got our main one, which is the Dyer Dow House, which is down on 5th Street. We have a museum, which is on J Avenue, just off Main. And then our big complex, which is the Briggs Terrace Evergreen Lane. I spend most of my time at Briggs Terrace Evergreen Lane, so I can do a lot more talking about that than I can about the museum and Dyer Dow.
But there's something I've always wanted to know. Whenever a new weather person's hired at WHO or KCCI, and they're from out of state, they call it Nevada, and we know it's Nevada. Now, why is it Nevada?
People in the old days, you sounded out words. And if you look at the A goes either an A or an A, so that's how it became Nevada. It's the way you sound it out by reading it.
Who founded Nevada?
It was founded in 1853. There were some surveyors. They wanted to make a county. One of the surveyors or commissioners that was with it is Joseph Trift, and he's the one that named Nevada. And with him at that time was a guy named T.E. Alderman. His doctors told him he had bad eyesight and he needed to find an indoor job, so he went looking for a place to start up a new business in the merchants. So he was actually the first settler in Nevada. Another note on him also is that he had the first child born in Nevada, and they also had the first death. His daughter was the first born and the first death in Nevada.
Boy, he's a history maker. Now, you've had your sesquicentennial then, haven't you?
Yes, we have. Yes, we had that back in 2003. We wrote a new book for that. We've actually got two books out on Nevada right now. We do have those at our museum, and you can get those at our local Ben Franklin on Main Street.
And there is still a Ben Franklin in Nevada.
Yes, there is.
Yes, there is.
And I hope to have it there for many, many years.
Uh-huh.
It's a great store.
Tell us about some events of importance have happened in Nevada's history.
Well, we share a famous person here in Ames with Nevada, and that's Billy Sunday. He came to work for a Colonel Scott in Nevada. He came to be a stable boy when he left the orphanage. And he actually played a little baseball, went to high school there before he moved off. Came over here back to Ames again, then went back over to Marshtown, then became a professional ball player, and then a professional evangelist.
Okay, well, you're a specialist on the Briggs Terrace Mansion.
I wouldn't call myself a specialist.
You're the guy there.
Yeah. We have a couple other people that are probably more knowledgeable on that than I am, and I know one, and her name's Joanne Hunt.
Okay.
She's probably more knowledgeable about that place, with especially the family. Mm-hmm. History. So,
well, this is a really beautiful property, and it does have an evergreen lane for sure leading up from the street to the house. And it's located on the east side of Nevada at 1204
H Avenue. Yes.
So here's a recording of our first impressions when we went to see the house and you introduced us to the house. Right now we're standing on a beautiful, beautiful property. Lawns with very old trees. Chris Corbin.
Yes. This is Briggs Terrace, Evergreen Lane. They started building on the grounds about 1877. And the property, the house, and what is considered the carriage house, the two big brick buildings on the ground, were actually finished in 1879. Bricks are actually from the town of Nevada. There was a brick and tile company outside of town, and that's where they got them from. They're not the oldest buildings on this ground.
Here's a little wooden building.
A little wood building is actually the oldest building on the property because that is what's called the workman's shed. The workmen came out of Chicago on the Chicago Northwestern, and then they were buggied up here. They were the master carpenters or the master bricklayers. They were the head of the group.
And they came here to build this house?
Yes, they came here to build this house.
So they built a house for themselves first?
Yes.
And they lived there?
Yes.
So it's a tiny little wooden house. It looks almost like a little one-room schoolhouse.
Now, the regular...
How many people lived in that little house?
There wouldn't have been that many. I mean, the day laborers would have been people they would have picked up from around the town.
So let's turn around. Behind us, there's this gorgeous brick house. What would you call this style?
I've never learned the style, but it is way ahead of its time. It has the concrete lintels, the base underneath the windowsill and above the windowsill. They're a pre-poured concrete lintel. Those are way ahead of their time. And the house was built in between 1877 and 1879. That didn't even get into the Chicago areas until the 1880s or later. So it's way ahead of its time.
So this was a modern house.
Very much so a modern house.
What were the other houses looking like?
There would have been regular farm homes, two-story type, but they're all pretty much wood. This one is prick. This meant money. It cost $10,000 at that time to build this house in 1877. Really, that was very expensive. So it's way ahead of its time.
So this is a house of stature.
Yes, it is. It was recently a private home up until about the end of the 1980s. And we took possession in 96. And then it went on the historical register in 1999.
What else should one know in terms of the architecture?
Well, it does have the what was called the widow's nest above. It's a little flat area clear up on top.
Of the roof?
Yeah. It has the metal railings. If you come back here, you can see a little bit better. You'll see that metal grate right up in there.
Oh, up on top of the roof, there's a very fancy black metal fence.
That's the best way to put it. Yeah, it's kind of a metal grate.
It's almost like a little balcony on top of the roof.
Yes, there used to be an access panel so you could get up and get through it.
What was the point of that?
Well, you get out and check your roof and that kind of stuff. But
it's very fancy for checking your roof.
I wouldn't have had one, but
a little structure up there that really doesn't serve a whole lot of purpose.
That's true.
A widow's nest is what?
Well, they used to call it when the sailors and stuff went off to sea. The widows would go up and they would look out to sea to see if, you know, their husbands were coming home. That's what
that's
it was
interesting.
For.
It's a style from the eastern seaboard where folks had that
but it also,
need to go.
It was that way, too, to show that you had money is because it was ornate and decorative. The railings in the front are the same metal. I mean, you had to have some good money to have someone do that kind of stuff.
The ornate decoration on the side of the roof, as it...
Another show of we had money.
This is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and we're talking about Nevada, Iowa today. Chris Corbin is with us from the Nevada Historical Society, and he's introducing us to a mansion turned museum in Nevada known as the Briggs Terrace Evergreen Lane.
We were just listening to a recording of Chris introducing us to the mansion as we stood in front of it in the evening sunlight. Chris then invited us in to explore the ground floor of the house, including the dining room, kitchen, and a formal parlor, and the family room. Here is some of what we saw there.
We'll go right inside here, and we'll go in the dining room area.
There's a bell here. What is this bell for?
That's actually the dinner bell.
That's a dinner bell.
Yeah. The kitchen's right off this back door here.
Okay.
You know, this was a working farm. Even though where our main street is today, it's what, about 5 or 6 blocks from here, is still, this was considered country. And they did have animals, and they did have some crop ground here, and they had a lot of hired hands out here that would work. And when it was dinner time, they would ring the bell and they'd come in, just like in the old farm days. We're going to go inside into the dining room.
And it has very fancy wallpaper.
Yes.
Beautiful pieces of furniture with...
Nice tea set. It had 3 pantries. You had one for your canned goods and, you know, the stuff that they made. And then your staples and spices were in the center one. And then this is where you kept your fine china.
And this is kind of an entrance into the kitchen here where the food could get passed through the wall.
Pass through so you can bring the food right in through the wall. And there was a little sink there at one time. The pantry has been actually brought back to its original color. They would keep your potatoes and your onions and your fruits and vegetables would be kept in here. And then you would keep your spices in this rack here.
There's a very large window that is maybe 8 to 10 feet high.
Yes, most of the windows are at least that high.
And it looks out onto a cheerful sight of hollyhocks and phlox and lilies and butterflies flitting around.
The garden.
Very beautiful.
Our master gardeners are doing the best they can right at the moment. We're in a new process of getting some. They're helping us out, and they're doing a wonderful job.
Floors are all wood, so they creak pleasantly. I like that.
This room is more formal because it looked fancier, because in those days, carpet was expensive. And you'll notice we have a rug down. But when you had carpet in here, you cheated a little bit. You didn't put the floor all the way through.
Oh, under the carpet there's plywood.
Actually, it's not parquet. Yes, and you'll notice all the woodworking in here. This is all done by hand. They didn't have power tools in those days. So everything that was done here was done with wood block planes.
What is this room?
I like to call it the wake room, actually. Because remember, in the old days, they didn't have funeral homes. So when someone passed away, they would have the funeral in the home. This would be the biggest room that they could hold people.
This is the formal room for company.
It's fancy, and they would put the coffin in here, and people would come see it. This is where you'd meet a lot of different people. They would come in. And the front door came from the corner of 11th and H, and then you'd walk up that diagonal sidewalk right up here to this porch, and you'd come in this way, and this is where they would greet people.
And then off to the side, there's an enormous door with
an entrance with
sliding doors, mm-hmm. and another room.
It's actually the family room.
It's got some chairs in it. They're not easy chairs. There's no TV. There's no computers.
No. You either read or you play music.
There is a...
That is a pump organ. And Irene Dutton was one of the last people who lived in the house. And she came in and she said, when I got here, I can remember a pump organ. And that looks very similar to it.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And we're talking about some of the history about Nevada. And Chris Corbin from the Nevada Historical Society is introducing us to the Mansion Museum in Nevada, which was built in 1879 at 1204 H Avenue for Otis Briggs, a banker. His daughter Lida lived in the house as an adult with her husband, and she renamed the house to Evergreen Lane. As we explored the family room of the house, Chris gave us a glimpse into the family that built and lived in this estate.
The picture on the one wall over here by the organ, that is Lida. Lida was the daughter of Dutton Briggs. His first wife, he had two kids, and then his first wife died in childbirth. And then his, I call it sister-in-law, but she was a half-sister, came to help with the children. Well, he fell in love with her, and they ended up marrying. And they had two other children, and Lida's one of them. Lida Dutton was really the biggest person that did stuff in this house. I mean, she was a daughter of the actual builder of the house. And when she got married to J.A. Dutton, they moved in here just before 1900. Supposedly, I've never met her. She died in the 50s, but they said she was a really lovely woman.
She looks like it, yeah.
Being the lady of the house, you didn't have a job, so you had to have something to do, and she loved to paint. If you'll notice what's called the transoms, those were above the door. All the transoms downstairs have paintings on them.
Describe what a transom is.
The transom is actually, there's a window above a door, and what that was to do is so you can let heat and air through from one room to the other. You didn't have a furnace or a fireplace in every room, so you had to get your heat through to different rooms, and that's where it would go through. And these transoms were actually painted by Lida, and then you'll notice a lot of these are more of that New Orleans look, waterfowl and that kind of stuff. But she loved them. She loved to travel to New Orleans. As a matter of fact, her and her daughter spent a lot of time in New Orleans during the winter. They traveled down there every winter. So pictures on this side are actually of her parents. And then, of course, you know the old pictures. Nobody smiled because their teeth were bad and all that
stuff. Yeah, it looked very severe.
Yeah. He was a doctor down in Des Moines.
But Lida actually lived here and farmed.
Yes. She didn't farm. Her husband, J.A., was a banker originally. And then they got into buying land. And then that's where they got into being the big-time farmers.
Who did the actual farming?
Well, most of it was tenant farmers.
And they did not live on the property?
No. They did have hired hands that actually did a lot of the work.
Any of the built the house came from Des Moines, from a doctor?
No. You got to go back to the original Orson Briggs. And when he came to Iowa, he was really kind of a watchmaker. And then he got into land speculation and that kind of stuff. And then he turned into being a banker. And he had the Farmers Bank here in town. J.A. Dutton was actually in the lumber business in a different town. He got to know Lida, but then he came to work. His brothers were into banking, and then he was into banking, and then the two came together, and he was a vice president of the bank. And so it was really pretty much was banking is the big thing. Then it turned over to farming after that because, back then, sometimes the banks didn't quite make it. So, and these people were very good. They knew what they needed to do, and they bought a lot of land. At one time, this household was probably the largest landowners in Story County.
And at that time, was it 100 acres?
Well, it would be a lot more than that.
1,000 acres?
Maybe more than that. They owned a lot of different farms, Because I can remember with my father, we'd go to some of the different farms, and they had them numbered, like farm 89 or 86. And you would go there. I don't know how many acres went with that farm, but they had someone there that was actually living on the property and then doing the farm work for them.
And what were they farming?
What we have today, corn, soybeans, that kind of stuff. They probably raised animals as well.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have animals on this ground. You had big gardens. I mean, not besides that Victorian garden we have out here, but they had a big garden that they would raise to help feed the house and all that stuff. Lyda had two children. She had Dorothy, and then she had Orson Dutton. Orson, and he was a very big man. I liked him, what I got to know of him. Orson lived until about 76, 77, somewhere in that area, 78.
And was Orson the person who turned this over to the city?
No, Irene, his wife.
She outlived him, and she owned the house?
Yes, and she owned the house. She moved out in the 80s, I think it was. Her granddaughter, Zoe, moved in here with her two boys. And she lived here until about mid-80s.
And how did they come to the decision to give the house to this? Does the house belong to the city?
No, it belongs to the Nevada Historical Society. Uh-huh. And we do all the maintaining and maintenance and all that stuff. I can't tell you exactly why they made that decision. I think a lot of it had to do with they hated to see this property go to housing development.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they thought the best option would be to give it to the Nevada Historical Society.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go upstairs.
Yes, we can go upstairs.
Well, here we are on Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're talking about Nevada, Iowa today. Chris Corbin is with us from the Nevada Historical Society, introducing us to a mansion-turned-museum in Nevada known as Briggs Terrace, Evergreen Lane.
The recording of our house tour stopped as we climbed the stairs, as you can hear. We were going up to explore the second floor, but the recording stopped because space in my field recording device ran out. The second floor was really almost more fascinating to me than the ground floor because there were so many remnants of the original family still there, and it really made the family real when we were up there. The beauty of going to visit this mansion is that you're not standing behind a roped-off room. You literally can walk around the room, and the objects that belong to the family are still there. And it's a really intimate experience. The original baby crib, Orson was there, and his perambulator, very remarkable objects. There was a fragment of Lyda's decorative mural in her bedroom. And you pointed out some other interesting features. One of the things you pointed out to me when we were going up the stairs was something called the coffin corner.
Yeah, you see these outcroves and stairways and stuff, and usually if it's just going up the regular straight part of the stairway, it's a decorative piece. When you get to a corner area, you have one of those. They're called a coffin corner. It was never used in this house, but the reason it got its name is because in the old days, like I say, you didn't have funeral homes. You'd have a funeral in the house, and a lot of people would die upstairs, and you couldn't just run down to the local store and say, I want a coffin. So normally you ordered one in advance, and then you would store it in your attic. And then when you'd come down, put the body in it, and then you'd bring it down the stairs so that you wouldn't hit that corner, they would put one like that
in there.
Have
an indentation in the
wall.
Yeah. You also pointed out that actually the husband and wife had separate bedrooms.
In most cases, yes, because in this situation, because the husband would get up earlier in the morning to go out and make sure his hired hands had their chores to do and all that stuff. So it was really early. The lady of the home would probably get up a little later to, you know, direct her and servants and stuff to do what they were supposed to do.
And there was one servant room upstairs, a servant bedroom, and it was noticeably different from the other rooms.
We call it the servant's room. Really, the servants never stayed in this place. Most of them came from the town itself. But that room was used by one of their hired hands, Mr. Irwick. It's really a just plain little room.
It's a little room with a slanted ceiling.
And a little window.
And a tiny window, whereas most of the rooms have, 10-foot ceilings, 12-foot ceilings?
Oh, they're at least 10.
Enormous windows. Very beautiful proportions to most of the rooms in the house. I did want to ask you a little bit about the grounds. It is very beautiful, and it does have some other structures on it.
Yeah, we have it's a little over 11 and a half acres there. And besides the home, we have what's called the carriage house. It was kind of a barn, but they stored the carriages in it. Besides that, we have the Haley one-room schoolhouse. We had that moved up there from the 4-H grounds. And we also have the George Child Log Cabin, which is also, you would have found out, to me, I look at it as it's a park. We've had a lot of different things there. We've had weddings on the grounds. People come up and take family pictures on the grounds. Every year, probably for the last 6 years, during prom, it seems like we get all the juniors and seniors who are going to go to prom. They all come up there and take their pictures there, and it's kind of a zoo once in a while with the amount of cars we get.
You have said that many people ask you this question. That house does not have a haunted feeling to it.
It doesn't.
It's a very pleasant place.
But I do have a couple little stories I can share. Years ago, I take care of the grounds, and I live across the street from it, so I get to watch people. And it was late one evening, and a guy drove up the driveway, and I thought, well, I better check this out. And he was out taking pictures. He's a paranormal, or what do you call those kind of people, that he wanted to check and see if there were any ghosts. Now, he never reported back to me, so I don't know if there ever was one. But I do have one personal experience, and I still can't explain it. I do all the mowing. Mm-hmm. And I do all that. It's all volunteer. So, and I'm over on the east side going back and forth and mowing along, and I see this gentleman in bib overalls standing up by the back porch smoking a pipe. Well, and I thought, normally when I see someone, I thought, well, I'll just go ask questions. Well, I whipped back and I turned around to come back and he wasn't there.
Mm.
So I shut the mower down and I thought, well, it's pretty good. It has pretty good speed. And I went clear around the house and I never found him.
Mm.
But I could still smell the pipe smoke. So,
okay.
Where'd he go?
Okay. With that, we shall say goodbye to Nevada. It is a beautiful museum to visit. Chris Corbin from the Nevada Historical Society, thank you so much.
We are open every Sunday from Labor Day to Memorial from 2 to 4. This weekend, we do have an activity going on at the Nevada Library. It's a race around Nevada. It's kind of a trivia questions, and you go find the spot and take pictures of it, and then you come back. And that starts at, you need to be there from 1:30. We'll send you out at 2, and then you have to be back by 4.
Okay. And
we do have a lot of other events going on as well.
If you want to see the mansion,
you can show up either at 2 to 4 on Sunday.
Okay.
Or if you want, there are some phone numbers when you drive in the driveway. There's a sign there. You can call someone and we can make an appointment. Or if you happen to see some big guy driving around on a lawnmower in the yard, just stop by and I'll be glad to give you a tour.
Or if you see someone smoking a pipe on the porch.
I hope not.
Okay, thank you so much, and we will post the link to your website
as well. All right, thank you very much.
Let's jump right ahead to Tuning Into Agriculture with Greta Anderson.
Welcome to Tuning Into Agriculture, a locally produced segment airing every Wednesday at this time on Local Talk. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. The Story County Fair opens this Saturday in Nevada, and 4-H kids around the county have been busy all week prepping the fairground barns for animal events, as well as baking favorite recipes, giving their animals haircuts, and putting finishing touches on the projects they will show. 17-year-old Chastity Moody of Maxwell, Iowa, is as busy as any of the youth involved in the fair.
I have a woodworking project this year, 2 clothing projects, a food and nutrition project, and I have 6 pigs that I've been walking since June 1st and feeding 3 times a day. And in order to have them fair ready and look nice and be able to get the money that we want and place how we want, we've been working with them so they're calm and they're used to being walked.
But for Chastity's main event, showing beef cattle, preparation is a year-round process as she shows heifers and steers from her family's herd of purebred Simmental cattle all year round.
With our cattle, we like to take them to open shows, and we show them at State Fair, show them at Winter Expo, the Simmental Field Day I show at a bunch of them, and it's very good for us to be active in livestock because that's a great publicity thing. It's a great learning experience. It's just great year-round to be able to always be in the barn, know what your livestock are, and so going to fair is another way to let people see what your farm has, what your farm can grow, how you raise your cattle and how much work you've put into them and how they look come time for fair since you've been working with them all year round.
On her grandmother's beautiful hilltop farm, Chastity led me into the barn to introduce me to the cattle she'll be showing next Tuesday in Nevada. The animals were huge and incredibly placid.
This is my breeding heifer, Loretta. That's my cow-calf pair. Cow's name is Maggie, and the calf's name is Minnie, because she looks exactly like Maggie. That's Charlie. He's my market steer. I'll show him in the carcass class, and I'll just show him as a market steer at fair.
And how old is Charlie?
May 5th, last year. We showed him last year as a cow-calf and got supreme cow-calf with him, and his mom is just getting too bossy now, so now we're taking Maggie to fair as cow-calf, so Beavis gets to stay in the pasture this year. Normally, when we come up here and work with them, feed them, let them eat, and while we let them eat, we go work with our pigs, and then come over, rinse the cows, or wash them. We rinse them every day, wash them every other day, and then my heifer that has really nice hair, and my cow and calf that have really nice hair, we try to blow them out every single day so their hair stays nice. We have a big blower in that other room that we use, and we put a mixture of Clean Sheen and Double Dip on them every single day, or we use Revive, and that keeps their hair conditioned and fresh and nice and makes it to where it still has that pop look. Normally it's about noon when we're done working with them and do all of that. Tie them up in front of the barn fan, and they sit there until it's chore time at night.
Chastity has definite ideas about the kind of livestock operation she wants to be part of.
I feel that I would rather be on a farm with only about a herd of 20, because so with only having 20 out there in the pasture, I can go out there after we feed silage and sit there and talk to all of them, play with all of them, versus if I had like 2,000 cattle out there in the pasture, I wouldn't care. I'd dump out the feed and walk away, and it'd just be selling them. This way I can actually get to know them. To me, I feel like that calms the calves down too, when they know who their owners are, not just someone that brings a tractor, dumps out the feed, and walks away.
Every year, she and her father sell beef steers to friends and family.
Our steers that we don't decide to show as show steers, they go to market and either sell them to other people, and they have our meat from the cows we have raised, quarters, halves, or whole cuts, depending on who wants to buy what. Or we keep them in our own freezers at home.
Direct sales is known to be more profitable for farmers than selling wholesale to a corporate processing plant. And as Chastity describes it, she recoups not just dollars, but also a big dose of pride in being able to provide food to family and friends. She talked to me about growing the herd, heifer by heifer. But how can such a small operation bring in profit in a world of 10,000 head cattle lots?
The answer for Chastity and her family is to develop a breeding herd to produce animals with such quality genetics that other cow-calf operations with larger herds want them for their own. Chastity described how they were using AI, or artificial insemination, using semen from quality Simmental bulls around the country to improve the herd. She also purchased Loretta, the breeding heifer she will show on Tuesday, in an effort to improve the herd's genetics. Here's Chastity describing Loretta's virtues.
When you think of a cow, you want someone that has big belly, nice muscle structure. Her udder's very good looking. She has a lot of meat over her rib cage. That's not showing. She's not too wasty in the neck. She's soft on her pasterns. The pasterns are in between the dew claws and the hoof, right at the base. And you want the calf to sit back on those. Normally, if they walk on their tiptoes, kind of, that means they're not as soft on the pasterns. And you want the calf to look more comfortable when it's walking and sit back on them. Right now we currently have a purebred Simmental herd, so we don't have a commercial herd right now. We have purebreds, which we think that's better because good Simmentals, they have good mothering abilities, which that's what we look for in a herd. So they milk good. They can adapt to the Iowa weather better. Like, we had a calf this year that was born out in the middle of a thunderstorm down in our creek, still lived perfectly fine the next day. Not all breeds will be able to do that. Simmental is very good to adapt to weather.
So folks might purchase a young heifer from you, is that the idea?
That is what we are looking for. And then after our herd has been developed, it's slowly getting more cows that are just AI'd and they're not from a random herd bull, then they have a lot better bloodlines and they will produce better calves, which give our farm more of a notice, so that way people want our cows more.
The big chance to win status as a breeder comes at the Iowa State Fair. And according to her father, who makes his living in construction, they'll be showing a bull, her heifer, Loretta, and another young heifer born from their own stock this year. But for now, Chasity Moody is focused on the week ahead.
I really like the carcass class. I've won the carcass class in the past. It's really nice to know that I have really good cattle here at my farm that produce a really good carcass and have nice meat.
So that's Charlie.
Charlie, hopefully, yes. Hopefully he wins.
If you win at the county fair, does that mean you go on to state, or is the state competition a separate thing you just enter?
The state fair is totally separate. All of our market steers go on the trailer after county fair. All of our pigs, besides the breeding gilts, go on the trailer.
You mean when they go on the trailer, that means they're heading toward a facility?
Yes, towards the slaughterhouse. And afterwards, part of the excitement of fair is getting your premium money from how well your steers cut, how well the carcass is. That's part of the carcass class. After Tyson's gives us all the results from the carcass and how our carcass was cut, that's how they determine who's won and who hasn't, depending on how nice or how not nice the carcass was cut.
So you say goodbye to Charlie.
Yeah, I'm probably going to cry like a little baby, because I showed him last year, and it's going to be hard. My dad keeps saying, hamburger, hamburger. I'm like, shut up. I'm like, he's not going. I'm taking him back home.
There'll be other calves, I guess.
Mm-hmm. There will be. I guess that's part of raising cattle. They always have to go sometime.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Chasity.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.
This has been Tuning Into Agriculture with your host, Greta Anderson, and music from Robert Schumann, The Happy Farmer.
Well, today you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Thank you for joining us today. I've been your host, Paul Wearson, together with Ursula Rudenberg.
Today we focused on the town of Nevada, a bit of its history, and we explored the museum, which is now called the Briggs Terrace Evergreen Lane, as well as being a very accessible house to explore, and it really is accessible. It gives you a first-hand view into a 19th century estate home. There's also a beautiful park area around the house that includes a one-room schoolhouse, museum, a log cabin, a carriage house, and more. I was saying to Paul just a few minutes ago that it's really kind of like going to somebody's house and just exploring. It doesn't feel like you're in a museum standing behind velvet ropes. So it's just a lot of fun. And there's a lot to see. Chris Corbin, who was here with us today at KHOI, is an excellent host and guide when you go to the museum. Chris is a volunteer at the Nevada Historical Society and is also their vice chair of the board.
We also heard about how some of the folks in Nevada practice community spirit. Resident Jessica Ianson today kindly shared her stories with us, and we thank her for that.
And we also spoke about the play that's going to be happening this weekend about Ulysses Grant.
Yes, Unconditional Surrender at Roland Story High School Auditorium. That'll be at 2 p.m. on Saturday. Peter Grady, and he's the star who wrote the show, too. And then the Harmony Brigade Barbershop Chorus at Elon Lutheran Church, Randall, 3 p.m. on Sunday.
And Greta Anderson interviewed Chasity Moody, competitor at the Story County Fair, for this week's Tuning Into Agriculture. Local Talk is on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m., and you can also listen to today's entire Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you'll also find information about the people you heard today on the show, along with contact information and links to the people, places, and things we talked about.
Local Talk was engineered by Becca Reuter. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Now, Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show, and if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as the audience is what makes KHOI possible. Today we're going to go out with the voice of our friend and KHOI volunteer, Fred Johnson, who passed away July 9th. We appreciated his contribution to KHOI and the time he did spend with us. I will miss his laugh. I can still hear it now in my head. There will be a memorial gathering for Fred at the Unity Church this Saturday, July 25th at 11 a.m. The Unity Church is located at Kellogg on 9th Street in Ames. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
This is Fred Johnson, and you're listening to KHOI, Story City, Ames, and surrounding communities.